This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Tequila is one of the most popular spirits in the United States, and its popularity is still growing. Imports to the U.S. have more than tripled in the last 20 years. And for decades, Mexico has tried to protect tequila and mezcal by placing strict regulations on where they can be produced. So in the early 2000s, when there was a shortage of the blue agave plant used to make tequila, producers took drastic steps to save the industry. They contracted with Mexican farmers to produce more crops, but those agreements turned out to heavily favor tequila companies, and they've had lasting impact on small farmers. Sarah Bowen has traced the recent production of tequila and mezcal in her new book, Divided Spirits, Tequila, Mezcal, and the Politics of Production. Sarah is a sociology professor at North Carolina State University and joins us now on the State of Things. Hello, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you.
So, first of all, we really have to get into talk about tequila and mezcal. They are protected names, right? I mean, these are, and so they have a special quality. Not just anybody can produce and make tequila and mezcal, right?
Right. So mezcal is, the word mezcal is a generic term for distilled agave spirits. But so tequila actually is a mezcal that's from the town of Tequila. And so that's the first thing, because a lot of people ask, what's the difference? But then they are unique in that tequila in 1974 became the first product outside of Europe to be protected by a denomination of origin, which says that it can only be produced in the state of Jalisco and then parts of four other states.
And we're familiar with this idea of designation of origin and with products like bourbon or champagne, right?
Right.
This kind of thing. But as you say, this is the first time outside of Europe that we've gotten this kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so then mezcal followed in 1994, and the Mexican government defined the territory where mezcal could be produced, which was ironic in a sense because mezcal is a generic term, but it's also a legal term. And so some people who produce mezcals can't actually call them mezcals.
All right. So now what is so there's a regional distinction. It can only come from these places. And then there's some other sort of defining quality issues around it. And blue agave is one of the principal among them, right?
Right. So tequila can only be made with one variety of agave. And then there are some rules in terms of the aging categories and things like that. Mezcal can be made with many varieties of agave, but the rules are somewhat similar to tequila. And in a lot of cases of denominations of origin, you might find a lot of rules in terms of what are the practices that are really important to this product and how it's developed over time. But in the case of tequila and mezcal, there really aren't that many rules for the production practices.
And the reason any industry would do this is because it gives them a kind of a marketing edge, right?
Right. So, and I think that's why they did it in Mexico, because there were people producing tequila mostly outside of Mexico, and so they wanted to make it a Mexican product. But it also has the potential to help farmers in rural communities. I don't think it has all that much in this case, especially with tequila, but it doesn't have to just be a marketing advantage.
But it does. And so tell us what happened, because tequila and mezcal, as you say, are both protected. But then there was a shortage of blue agave, which is the plant that makes tequila, in the early 2000s. So how did the tequila companies respond?
So they've dealt with shortages of agave for a long time, because agave is kind of a strange plant that takes 6 to 8 years to mature after it's planted. So that makes it complicated in terms of making sure that the supply is stable. And so in around 2000, this was due to the normal cycles. It was due to a frost and a pest infestation. They had a severe shortage. And so the tequila companies, even the biggest ones, were having to cut production because there wasn't enough agave and the price had gotten so high. And so in response, they decided they needed to be more self-sufficient in their supply of agave, and they started renting out land from farmers, including farmers in places that were within this big DO region but that had not historically grown agave. They'd grown corn and beans, and doing it themselves, the tequila companies managing the operations.
So tell us about the contracts then that they used to again, make this change in their relationship.
So for example, I actually got into this project looking at those contracts, and I was in southern Jalisco. And so they would give the farmers a certain amount of money, and then they would basically have control over their land. So the tequila companies in this case got to make the decisions over what chemicals to apply, how to do it. And the farmers, for them, the price of corn had gone down since NAFTA, so it seemed like a reasonable option to them. But the terms were sort of oriented towards the tequila companies, and the farmers were also very worried about what would their land be like when the contract ended, because that was going to be 6 to 8 years later. And then for independent farmers, you know, this was bad because they didn't really have the tequila companies were slowly cutting them out of the market altogether.
All right. So now you've got this again. This is in one way it saves the industry, but in another it is now changing the relationship between the producers and the companies then that do the processing. You first went to the tequila region in 2004. What did you see then, and how did things change when you went back in 2006?
So in 2004, that was in southern Jalisco, and so this was a place where they had been growing corn and beans, and they were switching over to agave because the tequila companies had come in and were offering these contracts. And they thought it. Some of them thought it seemed like a good idea, but I could see that it wasn't really working out very well for them. Some of them were planting their own agave, but it was clear that the prices were already starting to drop. And so when I went back in 2006, I was more focused. Then I went to Tequila, the town of Tequila. And in that case, I was more focused on what are the institutions that protect this industry that we've heard a lot about that could potentially help these farmers? And how are they, you know, who are they excluding? Who are they benefiting? Who's making these decisions?
And what did you find?
Well, tequila has I looked at the quality standards that have regulated tequila even before the denomination of origin, all the way back to 1949. And almost every decision made over that period has been pushed by the big tequila companies and the multinational liquor companies that eventually bought a lot of them out, and has marginalized both the small tequila companies and also the farmers, to the point where now, by that point we were in a surplus, the price had dropped below the cost of production, and a lot of the small farmers that I talked to then, you know, they couldn't sell their agave at all. They were being pushed out of the market, and they were really, really desperate.
You and we talked about the cycle for growing agave. It's a unique plant in that, unlike grapes, let's say, for wine production, it takes a long time for a grape vine to mature, but it produces annually from the same vine. Agave is a one and done, and yet it takes 6 to 8 years to mature.
Yes, and in the case of the agave plants they use for mezcal, sometimes even more. Mm. So that's one of the motivating factors behind some of the tequila company's decisions is to try to speed it up as much as they can because it does take so long to mature.
So therein lie the question about about quality control and changes in the techniques. And there's where some of the tension is today, not only the sort of loss of control that farmers have over the sale of their product and the production of it, but also the quality and the techniques they use. So tell us about what you found there.
So so the tequila companies, and this made sense from the point of view of cultivating agave in the most efficient way possible, they were breeding their plants in that way, and they were using more chemical-intensive methods, more pesticides, more fertilizers, instead of, for example, pruning by hand with a tool. And so these made sense from their point of view, but not necessarily from the environmental point of view. And then I also think that they weren't valuing the practices of these traditional agave farmers. And in fact, they were kind of taking away and doing what they used to do. So I think in terms of those aspects of quality, it really didn't make sense.
But in terms of the realities of global economic structures, the way in which we sell and buy these days globally, could local farmers using pruning shears rather than pesticides even keep up with the demands? Would they have stayed in business were it not for these other corporate practices?
Well, I mean, in some regions, those farmers have been resilient. In some places, they've been cultivating agave for several generations, and you know they continue to cultivate agave. And in the case of mezcal, where they use many varieties of agave, and the way and that is a valued part of the taste. You know, there's more attention, I would say, although some of the agave and mezcal is kind of going in the same direction, to thinking about how can we preserve these diverse varieties of agave and cultivate them in a sustainable way. And the tequila system, it's really vulnerable to pests and disease and these kind of cycles. So there are definitely costs associated with that.
Particularly when in the industrial agriculture techniques that came in with this new system in the early 2000s really promoted monoculture in a relatively small region. And so when you're actually opening yourself to more vulnerability, pests and other things, right?
Right. So tequila can reproduce itself with a shoot. And so you have these fields that are, many of them are identical. So it's complete monoculture, and then they're genetically very uniform, which makes them really vulnerable. And so people have talked about, you know, letting some of it flower and reproduce sexually, which would be much better in terms of the biodiversity and in terms of things like the bat population, which depends on that. And so I think there are some people and some companies talking about maybe we should do this a different way, but the dominant model is this monoculture.
Well, and the corporate culture, which looks at quarterly returns, can't wait. They just won't. They're not going to wait for that. So the idea that you've got these rustic practices is just, I would think, not tenable.
Especially
in corporate boardrooms.
If you're focused on volume, and many of the companies are.
So talk about the conversations you had, because you quote a lot of farmers in your book, as well as people who work in the companies. When you went in and started to do your research, it's interesting to see the reaction, the first thing that farmers would say to you when you walked to their door.
Well, I think a lot of them were surprised that someone from the United States had come all the way over, you know, to talk to them and to talk to them about what they were doing, because these were very small farmers. I had picked a random sample, so a lot of them had just a few acres and they were just kind of hanging on. And so I think they were surprised, and they were also at this point, this is when the price had fallen below the cost of production, and a lot of them were saying the tequila companies aren't even buying from farmers like us anymore. They were also desperate, and they hoped that maybe I could amplify their voices in a way. So I think those are the two things that they thought.
When you say that, the price, and because again, we get back to the risk. We're talking about a plant that's vulnerable, particularly when you practice monoculture. It takes a long time to produce, and it's an annual. So a lot of the risk was borne by farmers, but they also had the benefits. When corporations took over, how did they deal with the lower cost? They were then able to increase their profits, but essentially they pushed the risk off onto the farmers. And we're able to stay in business quite well during the down cycle, the price down cycle.
Yes. So the surplus was great for the tequila companies because it, you know, it had a big supply of agave that was at a very low cost. And the companies have been working with small farmers for a long time since the land redistribution with various types of arrangements. I think what is unique about what has happened in the last 10 years is that they've become even more self-sufficient and sort of really tried to insulate themselves from these cycles, although maybe not fully. But the farmers would talk about, you know, maybe we need a floor price for agave. The government could step in and help us out. They've done that for the tequila companies sometimes during shortages. But for the most part, both the companies and the government officials that I talked to said it's the farmer's responsibility to establish to find a contract first. And they put all the responsibility on these really small farmers who weren't going to have access to the kind of information or the credit that they might need to start cultivating their agave when things weren't looking so good for the farmers, and they just sort of displaced all of this risk to the farmers.
And that's some of what you heard from the farmers, which is, please tell our story. Please get the government to listen.
Yes. Yeah.
So maybe we should also take a deeper look at the history of mezcal. This is a mezcal-based drinks like tequila. It is a pre-Columbian beverage, is it not? This predates.
Well, that's the debate. Certainly the indigenous populations were producing fermented agave drinks for a very, very long time. And there is debate going on right now among archaeologists about whether distillation started after the arrival of the colonialists or before. And I think there's arguments on both sides. They agree that it mostly became widespread in the 1600s. So after the arrival of the colonialists, and they were very invested in trying to regulate and define that production. But some people say that it was pre-Columbian.
And now, as we pointed out at the beginning of this conversation, there is a legal distinction between tequila and mezcal. Mezcal is the sort of the generic term, tequila, this very specific protected term. And consumers are becoming wise to this, are they not? And understanding now some of the distinctions and what it might mean for them as consumers, but also for farmers in the region.
Yeah, I think that the U.S. consumers, and the U.S. consumes a lot of tequila and mezcal. We make a big part of the market, and they're increasingly savvy about both the denominations of origin and what these mean. And in the case of mezcal, I think just in the last few years, it's become a really trendy, hip kind of drink, especially traditional mezcal is made by small producers. And so people increasingly, I think, will talk about a particular variety of agave for mezcal or a particular practice and how they like that.
And this is because there's more variation, and some of them go back to some of the more rustic techniques or individual techniques in producing mezcal, not so much with tequila anymore. So there's a kind of a quality question anyway that that consumers are asking themselves.
Yeah, and I think to be fair, there are some tequila companies that are doing things in an interesting way, but the dominant trend in the industry is definitely towards these economies of scale. And but within mezcal, there's a lot of – I think that's the most interesting thing about mezcal, that it's still so diverse, and the production practices, the scale of the distilleries, the types of agaves vary according to regions within Mexico and even towns within those regions.
So you can get this kind of small batch, hyper-local, which has become, as you say, popular and trendy and may indeed have an impact on the quality. You also express optimism toward the end of your book that things are changing and perhaps farmers might be getting some traction again in their argument about how they're being treated.
I am a little bit optimistic, and I wasn't for a lot of my research, but I think especially with the rise of, you know, increasingly educated consumers in the U.S. and in Mexico, and people talking about issues of sustainability and traditional methods, that some things are starting to change. And there's a proposal that's out right now for a new standard that would regulate mezcal, and it would bring it much more in line with a lot of the things that some of the small producers and people that they worked with were telling me. So moving mezcal at least kind of away from the tequila model. So I'm hopeful, but there's also a lot of counter trends in there too.
Now, is there anything that the tequila producers would learn from this trend toward mezcal to say, well, all right, maybe we better rethink our practices, because are they losing actual market share, or is the overall pie growing?
I think that some of the tequila companies have learned from the mezcal producers, and so there are tequila companies that are talking about the terroir of their agave and where their agave comes from. We're talking about using certain traditional practices. As an industry, I think there's less perhaps going on in terms of the regulations. I think the tequila regulations are still very open, and so they kind of discourage small producers in that way. But I think so there's an organization called the Tequila Interchange Project, and they're working with a scientist in Mexico to develop a label for bat-friendly tequila. And I think I've heard they're working with the regulatory agencies. So that is an example of something that's at a more industry level that I think shows some promise. So I think they're taking note of what's happening in the case of mezcal.
Well, they're taking note, and one would be to change your practices. The other would be to influence the government. And there seems to be some suggestion of that in 2011. Legislation in Mexico that would favor the tequila companies by removing the word agave from any product that is not tequila.
So that's the other trend. So I think there are some positive trends, like I just talked about some of the tequila producers learning from mezcal. But I think that some of the really big distilleries are also threatened by this. And what happened in 2011 was an example of that. And then basically, and that proposal was defeated. But now the crazy part is that it's happening again. So just a few months ago, there was a proposal that would prohibit any producer outside of either of one of the DO regions. They're already not allowed to use the word mezcal, even though they would call what they make mezcal. And so now they would not be allowed to use the word agave on their labels either, and would have to call their products comil, which is using a term. It's an indigenous word that means, I think, alcoholic beverage, but not a term that people in Mexico are very familiar with, and certainly not consumers in other places. And so I think that's the opposite side, that the big distilleries are kind of threatened, I think, by some of these small producers and are trying to influence the laws in that way.
It's great work and a lot of terrific detail and terrific stories. Thank you so much, Sarah, for bringing it to our attention.
Thank you very much.
Sarah Bowen is a sociology professor at North Carolina State University. Her book is called Divided Spirits, Tequila, Mezcal, and the Politics of Production. We have information, of course, at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a new organization called Free Range Asheville aims to make the city's art more accessible. Stay tuned.